Well, long before U.S. companies started marketing burgers and crispy chicken abroad, an American advertising agent named Carl Crow set foot in China. He arrived in Shanghai in 1911 with one suitcase, and he stayed 3 decades. Crow died 60 years ago, but he left behind several books detailing his thoughts on life in the Far East. And as NPR's Louisa Lim reports from Shanghai, some of his instincts about the Chinese customer still hold true today.
Throughout Shanghai's turbulent 20s and roaring 30s, Carl Crow was a regular at the city's clubs. His day job was selling Pond's face cream, Buicks, and American cigarettes to the Chinese public. His other exploits included translating the rules of poker into Mandarin, negotiating with warlords, and writing a book called 400 Million Customers. To find out whether that's still relevant, I've distilled some of his advice into rules, which I've tested on a panel of modern-day Carl Crows.
My name is Tom Doctoroff. I am the Northeast Asia Area Director of JWT and the Greater China CEO. A year ago, published a book called Billions, Selling to the New Chinese Consumer.
Well, my name's Paul French. I'm the chief China representative of a company called Access Asia and the author of a biography on Carl Crow.
My name's James McGregor. I'm the author of 1 Billion Customers. I guess I've styled myself a bit after Carl Crow in that I'm a journalist turned businessman.
So let's hear what Carl Crow had to say about doing business in China in the 1930s.
Rule number one. No one will more stubbornly and successfully resist attempts to sell him something he does not want than the Chinese consumer, no matter what the price will be.
True. Products have to be put into a Chinese frame of mind. Chinese want to become modern. They want to become international. They don't want to become Western. Nothing in the world is going to make Chinese want to eat en masse crunchy, cold cereal in the morning.
Yeah, that's true. We find this now as well with people trying to bring into the market various products. The Chinese, despite lots of advertising, have not been consumers largely of lipstick. They've not been consumers largely of perfumes. Just because they sell well in the West, they don't necessarily sell in China. And not much you can do to convince a Chinese person that they should buy them.
Rule number two. Business deals in China are always full of surprises because until the transaction is finally concluded, no one can ever be quite sure that all the details of the transaction have been settled.
Yeah, it's funny. That's the way it is today, too. If you do a contract in China, that's like the opening round of negotiations, and then everything is fluid from then on out. If regulations say you can't do something, then there's ways to do it to go around that. It's what is this saying? Nothing is permitted and everything's possible in China?
People don't understand that the bargaining process continues even after a contract is signed. And I often find it wonderful when a trade delegation returns to the US or Europe and they announce, you know, X billion dollars worth of deals that have been done. And you'll find that those billions, if you're lucky, become millions. And if you're less than lucky, turn into hundreds of thousands.
Rule number three. A cardinal rule of conduct for the Chinese appears to be, do not do anything today if you can possibly put off doing it until tomorrow or the day after. This is not the philosophy of a lazy man. It's solely because of their timorous avoidance of responsibility.
Yeah, that's true. I think it's still that way with the government. It's not that way with the private sector. But in the government, it's always easy to say no. Why say yes? Because there's always a risk. But there is definitely not a manana attitude in China. It's get things done. I've had people who worked for me who slept under their desk, and I had to send them home.
We still have that problem today. The important lesson from that is, of course, is that, you know, your contacts need to be at the highest level possible in a company, or at least to someone who has the ear of the highest person possible. Otherwise, things will just get bogged down until you can eventually take out the boss to dinner and get him to make a decision in 5 seconds flat. And that's how it works.
Rule number four. In spite of our years of disillusionment, all of us secretly cherish the thought that a reasonable number of the 400 million Chinese may buy our goods next year.
basically a lot of what he's saying is true. But what he's missing is this incredible explosion of purchasing power that has happened on a mass level amongst the new middle class. The emergence of a new Chinese middle class is the consumer story of the 21st century. This did not exist in the 1930s.
He's talking about the dream of the huge market and the reality of the tiny market in those days. And even today, there's this dream of this gargantuan market, and even though it's getting to be a larger and larger market, the dream is always bigger. I think he's just pointing out the dream is out of kilter with the reality, but more and more, the reality is catching up.
But when it comes to doing business here, why has almost 60 years of communism apparently changed so little? As James McGregor put it, Chinese are commercial to their bone marrow. And 60 years of communism means little compared to 2,000 years of cultural determinism. It's a sign of just how much importance people place on wealth that instead of saying Happy New Year, people say congratulations on getting rich. With thanks to James McGregor, Paul French, Tom Doctoroff, and of course Carl Crowe for his insights from 70 years ago, I'm Louisa Lim, reporting for NPR News in Shanghai.
You can read more about what has and hasn't changed about doing business in China in an excerpt from Carl Crowe's book at npr.org.